Good afternoon or good morning to our attendees in Western time zones, and welcome to this EH&E-sponsored webinar entitled Meeting the Challenges of BSL 2+, When to Use It and How to Adapt It to Your Facility. Today's webinar will detail a practical approach to implementing BSL 3 practices and procedures in a BSL 2 environment, commonly referred to as BSL 2+. First, the logistics for today's webinar. We're broadcasting but not receiving today, so you can't ask questions via your telephone. Please type your questions into the chat box on the right side of your screen at any time during the presentation, and we'll answer as many as possible during a 15-minute Q&A period at the end. We're recording the audio portion of the webinar, and we'll make this available within a few days for download. You'll be notified by email when this is available. EH&E is a consulting firm specializing in the support of critical environments, both the environment itself, i.e. building systems, and the processes within. We currently manage the biosafety and environmental health and safety programs at several large research institutions, so our consulting staff is well versed on your day-to-day needs and challenges. Our presentation today will be made by Betsy Gilman-Duane. Betsy is a practice group leader overseeing EH&E's biosafety programs. She provides operational guidance and technical support and leads a team of biosafety officers. Betsy has over 20 years of experience in academia and industry, leading EH&S programs and specializing in biological safety. She is registered and certified in the professional practice of biological safety through the American Biological Safety Association, or ABSA. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Betsy.
Thanks, Bob, and welcome, everyone. This webinar is a result of a project that began a few months ago to look at what many call biosafety level 2+. There was quite a bit of dialogue in the biosafety community on what 2+ is and what it isn't. There were a lot of questions and not a lot of resource materials on this topic. Thus, EH&E dedicated to create and deploy a short survey to gain some feedback from our clients and others who volunteered to take the survey. Based on the results, we determined that many in the biosafety community are faced with challenges when determining when to use BSL 2+ and how to implement it. A white paper was written that many of you have probably seen, and this webinar is based on that white paper. After a brief introduction, we'll look at BSL 2+ in some detail, provide some examples, and explain how the risk assessment process is key and how it's an important part of the overall project review process. From there, we'll look at BSL 3 practices as well as BSL 2 facilities. These are what constitute the 2+ designation. I'll also include a few what-if scenarios and close with a case study. We'll also have time for a question and answer session based on questions we've received from you prior to the webinar and questions that may be received during the webinar, as Bob described how we can take questions at the end of the presentation. As I mentioned, EH&E conducted a survey earlier this year to get a sense of the challenges that various entities face when implementing BSL 2+. We found that respondents indicated that the three most challenging areas for them included how to determine what projects require BSL 3 practices, how to ensure that researchers are properly trained, and how to ensure that the principal investigator develops a project-specific standard operating procedure, or SOP. Throughout this presentation, I'll be providing some best practices and strategy for dealing with these three areas. So we've been using the term BSL 2+ for a few minutes now, but what does it really mean? Just as a refresher, there are four recognized biosafety levels, 1, 2, 3, and 4, which are a combination of practices and procedures, safety equipment, and facilities. Historically, BSL-2 Plus has meant the use of selected BSL-3 practices and procedures in a BSL-2 laboratory facility. Some have referred to BSL-2 Plus as BSL-2 Enhanced or BSL-2 with stipulations. Some entities have a very specific purpose for BSL-2 Plus. For example, they use it for work with lentivirus and thus call it BSL-2 Plus lentivirus. There has been a lot of discussion lately as to whether it's a recognized containment level. While it isn't recognized officially as a containment level in the BMBL, which is CDC NIH's Biosafety in Microbiological and Biomedical Laboratories, there is no reason why it can't be used successfully to ensure the safe conduct of research when arrived at via the risk assessment process. I need to caution you, however, it is not to be used for risk group 3 pathogens that are infectious via the inhalation route, where the BSL-3 laboratory facility is a key part of the containment process. The risk assessment process is key to arriving at the most appropriate biosafety level, no matter what the final biosafety level may be. It's also important to engage the principal investigator early on in the process, as well as the Institutional Biosafety Committee for recombinant work, or other safety or biosafety committee for non-recombinant work. For those of you at institutions receiving federal funding and/or covered by a local ordinance, the NIH recombinant DNA guidelines will apply, and thus you would have an Institutional Biosafety Committee, or IBC, for reviewing and approving all projects that involve recombinant DNA. For non-recombinant projects, you can either use your existing Institutional Biosafety Committee or another safety-related committee that you have at your institution. Ultimately, there must be consensus between all parties on the risk assessment. What type of work might be done in a BSL-2 laboratory with BSL-3 practices? While this is not an exhaustive list, a few examples include the use of lentiviral vectors where the gene insert is an oncogene or perhaps a gene of unknown function. The vector itself is traditionally replication incompetent, but it's the gene insert that often causes concern. You would not want to sustain a needle stick with this material and have a health consequence as a result of introducing the gene into your body. Thus, extra precautions, such as limiting sharps, is a good idea. Some HIV research might be conducted with BSL-3 practices in a BSL-2 lab, again, dependent on the risk assessment, but likely to include practices that reduce the risk of exposure through needle sticks or cuts with sharp objects and contact with skin and mucous membranes. It may also depend on the virus titer and volumes. Low titer, low volume work could potentially be conducted at BSL-2 Plus, while high titer, high volume work would likely be at BSL-3. And finally, Neisseria meningitidis serogroup B, a risk group 2 pathogen with no vaccine, is a prime candidate for BSL-3 practices, and we'll look at a case study a bit later as to why this makes sense. For the process of conducting a risk assessment, I refer you to the BMBL, where risk assessment process is detailed in great length. But let's take a moment to review the basics. First, start with the identification of the agent hazards and perform an initial assessment of risk. Items to consider may include the capability of the agent to infect and cause disease in susceptible humans, the severity of the disease, and the availability of preventive measures such as vaccines and effective treatments such as antibiotics for bacterial infections. Then, identify the laboratory procedure hazards. What is the concentration of the agent? What are the culture volumes? what equipment will be used, and what is the potential for aerosols to be generated. And are sharps, such as needles and syringes, planned for use in the project? From there, make a determination of the appropriate biosafety level and select additional precautions indicated by the risk assessment. This is where the plus comes in terms of BSL 2+. Next, evaluate the research staff that will work with the agent. Do they have prior experience working with the agent, and do they know how to safely handle the agent? Is the principal investigator responsible enough to train the lab staff? Are staff members proficient in good aseptic technique and the use of biological safety cabinets? And are staff members knowledgeable about what to do in emergency settings, such as spills? I've actually been known to require research staff to practice their techniques with water before they are allowed to work with virus, for example. This allows them to learn the techniques and get comfortable with the work setting and equipment before they actually handle something hazardous. Lastly, review the risk assessment with a biosafety professional, subject matter expert, and any relevant committees, such as the Institutional Biosafety Committee. I do want to circle back to the particular piece of the BMBL section on risk assessment, and that is a section that says, after determination of the appropriate biosafety level, it is important to select additional precautions as indicated by the risk assessment. So whether you believe that BSL 2+ is or isn't a containment level, the BMBL clearly states that one can select BSL 2 and require additional practices and procedures to enhance the safety of the work. I would also caution you that a one-size-fits-all BSL 2+ is not a good idea. That means that it's not advisable to just take all of the BSL 3 practices from the BMBL and apply them to each and every project that is deemed to be BSL 2+. Some of the practices might not add any value or enhance the safety of the work. So please pick and choose carefully. Prior to and concurrent with the risk assessment process, the project review must take place. There should be some sort of document that the principal investigator utilizes to detail the proposed work that becomes a part of the risk assessment. The biosafety officer reviews the document as part of the risk assessment and initiates a dialogue with the principal investigator and the members of the Institutional Biosafety Committee as needed. Some entities utilize an electronic system to capture project registrations. That's certainly optimal, but a paper form is fine as long as all of the relevant information is collected. I do suggest that some sort of annual review take place after the project is approved, as science and personnel do change, and it's important that the principal investigator document these changes. In some cases, this may actually require a new risk assessment. The next step is to identify the appropriate lab space. We'll dive deeper into that in a few minutes. Unless there is already BSL 2 lab space dedicated to work with BSL 3 practices, it may be necessary to work with the principal investigator to identify the appropriate lab space. In addition, the principal investigator develops a project-specific standard operating procedure, or SOP, with the assistance of the biosafety officer. Typically, the SOP starts with a template that the biosafety officer has prepared. It contains a lot of fill-in-the-blanks that guide the principal investigator through the process of capturing the relevant information. This does not have to be a long document. In most cases, a one-page document is all that's needed and also facilitates convenient posting in the lab. Don't forget that the institution should already have a biosafety manual, so the SOP is in addition to that manual. The IBC or equivalent committee must review and come to consensus on the project registration document and the need for selected BSL-3 practices. Finally, after the work is approved, the risk communication piece is key, as well as appropriate training. This is not limited to just the lab personnel, but may also include other environmental health and safety colleagues, as well as facilities and custodial support personnel, as typically access is limited and this needs to be communicated to everyone who may have a reason to need access to the BSL 2+ lab. Let's circle back to the survey that EH&E conducted earlier this year. As I mentioned earlier, respondents indicated that they were most challenged with regard to ensuring that researchers are properly trained and ensuring that the principal investigator or his or her designee develops a project-specific standard operating procedure. Let's talk for a moment on some strategies. As previously mentioned, an SOP template is really the best practice and likely to get the best response from the principal investigator. If you ask him or her to write something from scratch, you're probably not going to get a good response. Ideally, this can be put on one page, which facilitates staff actually reading it. It also makes it easy to post on the lab door and inside the lab, and it serves as a training tool. My experiences with BSL-2+ training are very hands-on. After ensuring that the staff are up to date with all required basic biosafety, bloodborne pathogens, and laboratory safety training, I schedule a training session to be held in the BSL-2+ lab before the work can begin. This is also tied to lab access, as key card access or keys, for example, can be given after training is completed. The training basically steps through the SOP, allowing staff to ask questions and engage in discussions. It also gives me the opportunity to assess whether additional training might be needed. For example, if a staff member says she has never worked with lentiviral vectors, I will circle back with the principal investigator and together we'll find a staff member to mentor the member of the lab who has never worked with the vector. If I don't think a lab member shows sufficient understanding of the safe and effective use of the biosafety cabinet, I might take additional time to review this during the training session in the lab. Again, it might not be practical or necessary to take all of the BSL-3 practices from the BMBL and apply them to every BSL-2+ project at your institution. Let's look at some examples. Is it safer if all of the waste from the lab is autoclaved prior to disposal? First and foremost, follow any applicable local and state regulations that apply to your facility. If your institution incinerates all biomedical waste, there may not be a need to autoclave it before packaging it and sending it out with a vendor for incineration. If there's no autoclave in close proximity to the 2+ lab, hauling it through the building in a covered container to the autoclave introduces an extra step in the process. Through the risk assessment, it should be determined if autoclaving adds value from the perspective of protecting people and the environment prior to disposing of the waste. Should waste that has been bleached in a 2+ lab be autoclaved? Absolutely not. This is overkill, assuming the bleach is effective against the organisms in use. And bleach is not compatible with the autoclave and will lead to premature wear and corrosion and the release of chlorine gas. Many institutions require the use of solid front gowns, as shown in this picture. They are mostly the disposable type, but could be reusable as long as there's a way to autoclave it before it's washed. Alternatively, through the risk assessment, one might conclude that safety is enhanced by wearing disposable sleeve covers over the cotton lab coat. What about allowing regular trash cans in the BSL 2 Plus lab for disposal of non-biohazardous waste, such as plastic wrappers from consumables? Personally, I don't like this practice as it can lead to a blurring of the segregation requirements. At some point, it's quite possible someone will pick the can that's closest to them, regardless of whether it's the correct disposal container. And since we can't always see contamination with our eyes, how do you know that the plastic wrapper is not contaminated? When it comes to selecting a BSL 2 Plus facility, there are a few key points to keep in mind. First, the whole idea of enhancing the practices and procedures really means the work must be separate from other work that is conducted at BSL 2. If the separation is not clear, it leads to blurring of the practices and procedures, and before long, the 2 Plus work doesn't look much different from the 2 work. We also want to put as much equipment into the 2 Plus lab as possible. Probably the only realistic exception to that is a large minus 80 freezer that can be located outside of the 2 Plus space. As long as materials from the 2 Plus lab are transported in labeled secondary containers and the procedure is detailed on the standard operating procedure and approved by the Institutional Biosafety Committee. And keep in mind, we don't need a lot of bench space in the lab, as one of the key elements of 2 Plus is working within the biosafety cabinet. Also consider what information technology infrastructure you may need. For example, it's not a good idea to take lab notebooks in and out of the BSL 2 Plus lab. Practices and procedures for BSL 3 would not allow this. So you will need a way to move lab data out to office areas. Some possible routes include installing a fax machine inside the BSL 2 Plus lab or dedicating a laptop computer to the lab. A simple and inexpensive alternative, if you have windows in the lab, is to tape notes to the window and then copy the information from the external side of the lab. Also, you may consider putting a phone in the lab so staff can call out in the event of an emergency. Typically, a small lab room or BSL 2 tissue culture room is selected for the 2 Plus lab. This also supports the limited access provision, as it's only practical for a small number of people to work in the space at any given time. If you're renovating or constructing lab space, you have some options to consider for 2 Plus. These are nice-to-have items, such as an anteroom for personal protective equipment storage with a sink, and hands-free sinks in the laboratory area. Some of these facility features are borrowed from BSL 3 facility criteria, as noted in the BMBL. I would encourage you to review the BSL 3 facility criteria if you're renovating or constructing and identify any of the BSL 3 facility requirements that may add value to the BSL 2 Plus lab space. It's been my experience that staff really like the hands-free sinks, for example. Here's a typical lab layout. Very simple, nothing fancy. We have a door with storage for PPE to the right of the door as you enter the lab. There's a sink also located near the door, could be hands-free or traditional sink. We have two biosafety cabinets located as far away from the door as possible. That basically means that up to two people can work in the lab at any given time. I had one BSL 2 Plus lab once that was a small room, basically comfortable for only one person at a time, but many people needed access to this lab throughout the day, and there was only one biosafety cabinet. During the training, we went over how to reserve time in the lab. The lab personnel basically had a calendar on the door, and you signed up for the time in advance. Very simple, but it worked well and ensured that everyone got the time they needed in the lab. There's also space for equipment in this lab, such as a tabletop centrifuge and a stack of incubators, and the lab has a fax machine. Since I like to think that biosafety is not a cookbook, there are often what-if scenarios that arise when performing work at 2PLUS. Here are a few that have occurred. What if the BSL 2PLUS lab is large enough to accommodate BSL 2 work? Can it be done concurrently with the 2PLUS work? The answer is maybe. However, best practice is to default to the BSL 3 practices. You really can't have two sets of requirements for people working in the same lab at the same time. After a while, there tends to be some blurring of practices and procedures, and the whole point of the BSL-3 practices will be lost. Also, you will need to consider training the non-BSL-2-plus staff, just like you would the BSL-2-plus staff. So again, you have a level playing field. What if the BSL-2-plus project occurs infrequently, like 2 days per quarter, and lab space is at a premium? Can we use the 2-plus lab for other BSL-2 work? Again, the answer is maybe. This would need to be outlined in the standard operating procedure, and signage would need to be able to be flipped from BSL-2 to BSL-2-plus, depending on the work that is taking place in the lab at that time. There would also need to be clear expectations of what is necessary to return the lab to BSL-2 after the 2-plus work is completed. Likely, we are not talking about a space decontamination with vaporized hydrogen peroxide or chlorine dioxide, but more along the lines of surface decontamination and removal of waste prior to converting the lab back to BSL-2. On to the case study. For the case study, I have selected Neisseria meningitidis serogroup B for a variety of reasons. Sadly, a death occurred in a laboratory worker in San Francisco earlier this year. He was infected with the serogroup B, which was used in the lab's research program. There is no vaccine for serogroup B, which is why the lab was conducting research, and the infectious dose is also unknown. It's a risk group 2 agent, and infectious via injection, ingestion, and via droplet exposure to mucous membranes. There has been some talk in the biosafety and scientific community about whether this agent should be handled with selected BSL-3 practices, or essentially at BSL-2+. Unfortunately, at this point, we don't know what exactly led to this lab-acquired infection. Let's assume for this case study that it's November 2012 and that we have a principal investigator who has heard about the death in California and absolutely does not want a similar situation to occur in his lab while they work with Neisseria meningitidis serogroup B. He is therefore proposing a new research project to begin in the first quarter of 2013. The principal investigator has approached the biosafety officer about this proposed work and voiced his concerns that doing the work in his large BSL-2 lab may not be the best way to ensure safety of all of his laboratory scientists. He thinks a better approach is to segregate this work so that only those on the project need to be in the lab and that additional work practices might be advisable. For example, the principal investigator is concerned that cotton lab coats that are used by his lab staff may become contaminated and potentially track contamination through the main BSL-2 lab areas. The biosafety officer agrees after reviewing the proposed project and the task to be conducted with this bacteria. and together, the principal investigator and the biosafety officer discussed the option of conducting this work in a smaller tissue culture room that could be converted to the BSL-2 Plus lab. The principal investigator, the biosafety officer, and the institutional biosafety committee all agree that the conservative approach makes sense and practices above and beyond the traditional BSL-2 practices are required for this project. It should also be noted that occupational medicine personnel also participated in the review and provided input to the principal investigator, the biosafety officer, and the institutional biosafety committee. For this project, the small BSL-2 tissue culture room was selected and was dedicated to this work. The facility was able to install key card access for those registered and trained on the project, along with the biosafety officer and selected members of the EH&S department. The biosafety officer provided the training in the lab for all personnel. The lab has a sink for hand washing, two biosafety cabinets, an incubator stack, a tabletop centrifuge with safety covers, and a phone and fax machine. The fax machine allows for lab notes to be sent to non-lab areas so that notebooks and papers are not removed from the lab. There was institutional biosafety committee approval to use the minus 80 freezer that was located just outside the lab in an equipment alcove. Hooks were installed just inside the door of the lab to allow for disposable lab gowns to be hung up for reuse, assuming they were not overtly contaminated. And there was additional space dedicated for things like eye and face protection and disposable gloves. The principal investigator appointed a longtime lab technician to be the 2-plus lab manager, responsible for making sure that items such as soap and paper towels for hand washing are available, and disinfectant solutions and personal protective equipment are readily available. This is actually a practice that I've seen with other BSL 2-plus labs, where there is one person who's appointed to manage or oversee the functions in the lab. For personal protective equipment, solid front disposable gowns with cuffed sleeves were selected, along with disposable nitrile gloves and safety glasses with side shields. Given that injection is a route of exposure, all sharps and glassware were banned. Plasticware was used instead of glassware. There was an autoclave down the hall from the lab, so the lab manager was responsible for ensuring that the lab personnel transported their waste in covered secondary containers to the autoclave at the completion of the day. No regular trash containers were allowed in the lab, and custodial personnel were not authorized to access the lab. A ready-mixed bleach product was selected along with 70% ethanol for disinfection purposes for surfaces and equipment. The standard operating procedure was posted along with emergency information on both sides of the lab door and was the basis of the in-the-lab training that the biosafety officer conducted for all authorized personnel. It also should be noted that the lab staff not participating in this project were extremely happy to learn that this work will be segregated from the rest of the lab areas. In summary, the use of BSL-3 practices in a BSL-2 lab, or BSL-2 Plus, is a viable option for some research projects. The key is the risk assessment process and involvement by the principal investigator, biosafety officer, institutional biosafety committee, and also the laboratory staff. Selection of the BSL-3 practices and procedures is important from the perspective of enhancing the safety of the project. Thanks again for participating today. We'll now turn to some questions that have come in from participants.
Thanks very much, Betsy. This concludes the presentation portion of today's webinar, and we're now going to proceed directly to the Q&A period. Again, please submit any questions you'd like asked via the chat box located in the bottom right of your screen. And there have already been a number of questions submitted.
Excellent.
So let's let me start you off with an easy one.
Okay.
Do we receive a certificate via email once we complete this webinar?
I believe we do, but we'll check with Kirsten and let all participants know whether that's possible. I do want to mention for those of you that are on today that may have a credential such as the registered biosafety professional or the certified biosafety professional through ABSA, I will be submitting the contents of this webinar and description and the time parameters to the American Biological Safety Association so that hopefully we can get some certification maintenance points for the RBP and the CBSP people that are on the line today. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. They do have some stringent requirements, but we'll do our best to get you credit for that. And that would be posted on the ABSA website if that occurs.
Okay, then let's get into the meat of them here. Betsy, do you have an SOP template for level 2 plus that you'd be willing to provide or share?
I do have a variety of templates. I typically like to really, customize it so that, there's really not one size fits all on the template. I'd certainly be happy to work with anyone that's interested in, some assistance with, creating the appropriate template. But think about some of the practices and the procedures that we talked about today, and that can easily be your starting point. But I'd like to think that there's really no one-size-fits-all template. But contact me offline if that's something that we might be able to help you with.
All right. Here's another question. I'm not sure I understand why notebooks can't be used. The room is not contaminated.
That's correct, but in the process of actually taking those notes, if you weren't very careful and removed your gloves and washed your hands before taking the notes, there's a good chance that you would actually contaminate the pen or the pencil, and maybe that gets stuck in the notebook and finds its way out of the lab with the notebook. You might contact the pages in the notebook, and then you take that out of the lab, and it's at your desk, and you're drinking your coffee or eating your sandwich for lunch. So I agree that in principle, the notebook or the lab is not contaminated, and therefore the notebook shouldn't, assuming that you don't put it right in the area where you're working. There is a potential for, the notebook in internal surfaces or external surfaces to be contaminated just by nature of the activities that occur in the lab. So therefore, it's really not best practice to take notebooks in and out. And I would strongly suggest, some sort of a fax machine, laptop, or I've even seen people tape the notes to the window and copy them on the other side. And in my experience, I've never run into anyone that has resisted one of those methods.
Okay. In the BSL 2 Plus, most of the places I visit have no anteroom. Please clarify if this is a must.
It's definitely not a must. It's one of those nice to have. I've seen people who are renovating space and have the opportunity to dedicate a very small footprint to an anteroom. They add that in. It just facilitates the supply of, personal protective equipment. Oftentimes you put a small sink in there. So it's absolutely not required. It's one of those nice to have. It facilitates, the flow in and out of the lab in respect to, personal protective equipment storage. It helps oftentimes the 2-plus lab. It's very small, and you really don't have a lot of, space for extra boxes of gloves and things like that. So the anteroom gives you a little bit of extra space. So nice to have if you can do it, but not absolutely required.
Okay, here's another one. All work would be done in containment. So I'm surprised there is no mention of safety cups being mandatory for centrifuge use and only opened in the biosafety cabinet, which supports all work in containment.
Yes, that's a really good point. So while we didn't have an opportunity to dive really deep into every single procedure today, that's definitely something that should be mentioned. So it's just good practice and should be a requirement that safety cups be used at 2+ and also at biosafety level 2. The last thing you want is to have, you know, a tube or something leak or explode in a centrifuge and have to deal with the cleanup regardless of what the risk group of the material is. And obviously as the risk group increases, so does the potential for adverse health consequences. So yes, absolutely. I would say best practice is also for BSL-2, also with 2+ on the centrifuge safety cups, and loading and unloading in the biosafety cabinet, and then also obviously performing all procedures that could splash, splatter, or create aerosols in the biosafety cabinet.
If you use a fax machine to get notes out of the lab, does that piece of equipment become dedicated to the lab, or can it be decontaminated?
It's dedicated to the lab, so you know, if it were to break, you have a couple of options. You know, if a repair technician, you know, can take a look at it, you can have the lab manager, you know, accompany that person into the lab. Obviously, you want to make sure that no work is taking place in the lab, that appropriate personal protective equipment requirements are followed, and any training, you know, hazard communication is provided before you bring that service technician in. That's one option. And certainly before that actually happens, the external surfaces of the fax machine should be wiped down with a disinfectant that, you know, will be compatible with the fax machine surfaces. If you needed to take it out of the lab, surface decontamination, there should be really no reason to do anything more than that, like tent it and, you know, use vaporized hydrogen peroxide. But this is where I would get the biosafety officer involved, and, you know, it's a form of a risk assessment in terms of, you know, what's the best way to deal with that fax machine that's no longer working correctly.
Since BSL-2+ suggests all work in containment, then no aerosol should be in the lab contaminating the notebooks if there is such a risk. If such contamination is a risk, then why would you not elevate it to BSL-3?
Well, let me circle back on the notebook issue there. It is usually common practice that people want their notebooks close to where they're doing the work, and I've often seen, you know, at BSL-2, for example, notebooks on or near the front, you know, work surfaces of the biosafety cabinet. So, you know, it's really not practical for somebody necessarily to put their lab notebook over on a clean, you know, bench surface and then be running back and forth. As far as the decision between biosafety level 2+ and level 3, again, go back to the risk assessment, you know, look at the agent or agents in use, and, you know, we really have to focus in on, you know, things like risk group 3 pathogens are definitely infectious via inhalation. And so, yes, you would be using a biosafety cabinet at 2+ and also level 3 to control infectious aerosols. You need to go back to the nature of the agent, and something like Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which we know is a risk group 3 pathogen, it's infectious via inhalation, you know, that would obviously belong at biosafety level 3.
Here's another templates question. I'm interested in templates for risk assessment. Are there good resources to go to?
Yes. So I know that a lot of institutions have created their own forms, so that's certainly something that you can, you know, Google and see what comes up and beg, borrow, and steal from others, which is, I think, you know, biosafety profession is a small profession in terms of other EHS disciplines, and we all like to try to really support each other. So try that method. The other thing is that if you actually look at the BMBL, for example, you could create the chapter on risk assessment. You could actually probably convert that into a risk assessment template. You may also want to look at Applied Biosafety, which is the journal of the American Biological Safety Association. There are a lot of good articles there. The journal's been in publication for probably easily 15 years. And I believe that you will find a lot of, you know, good examples there, maybe for specific agents, and also the risk assessment process as well. And then there's a book that is printed by the American Society for Microbiology, and it's a biosafety handbook, and there's certainly content in there that guides you through the risk assessment process. So, again, I don't know if there's really a one-size-fits-all, and I think, you know, your biosafety committee and, you know, the aspects of your program need to be factored in as well. But those are some resources where you may, you know, find some things that would be quite useful.
Is there a list of available of agents that the industry would agree would warrant a BSL 2 plus rating?
Not that I know of. Again, I would really go back to the risk assessment piece. You know, some of it also depends on how conservative your institution is. I know that years ago at a former employer, we were tasked with the first lentivirus project review at the Institutional Biosafety Committee. And the committee asked me as the biosafety officer to really, you know, see what others were doing for the same type of work. And this was lentivirus with oncogenes and also some genes of unknown function. So really didn't know what would happen if you stuck yourself with it. So I did a little bit of informal benchmarking, and I found about 50% of the folks that I spoke to, about both in industry and academia, said, oh, you know, our committee just says, you know, that's BL2. The other 50% would put it in the 2-plus bucket. So, you know, it really depended on a number of factors, you know, how conservative your institution is and your committee, logistical things like, you know, are you dealing with, you know, one really large biosafety level 2 lab? It's really not conducive to 2-plus. Do you have the opportunity to segregate the work in a smaller, you know, 2-plus room? So a lot of factors, you know, play into that. But no, I don't know of any, you know, standardized list that everyone would agree on.
Here's a good observation. I actually noticed this too. You in your diagram, you have two biosafety cabinets facing each other in a room, and the audience member mentions that there should be a minimum distance in the setup so as not to interfere with the airflow.
Yes, I totally agree. And so the diagram is not to scale. The main point is that those cabinets are nowhere near the door to the lab. Unfortunately, I've seen labs set up where the biosafety cabinets are near the door, and where do you think the sink is? As far away from the door as possible, so not optimal. So yes, you do want to keep them away from the door, but you want to make sure that they're not so close as to, you know, prevent to create an issue where people might back into each other, or that you have airflow issues that may compromise the integrity of the cabinet.
Do you find that workers are using disposable sleeves in BSL 2+?
I've seen a little bit of that. Personally, I see the most use of disposable solid front gowns. I think people just find that they're more convenient. They take off their cotton lab coat, they swap it out for a disposable solid front gown. One sort of tip that I've seen is that, you know, people are like, well, those gowns are sort of expensive, and, you know, our lab budget is limited, so we'll just take a magic marker and write our initials on the gown and then hang it up. We get somebody to install some, you know, inexpensive pegs or hooks. And, you know, you might come in the morning, do a little bit of work. You really haven't, you know, overtly contaminated your gown. You know you're coming back in the afternoon, so you take it off, you hang it up, you know, put your initials on it. And you come back later and you wear it again. So, you know, while I don't think you should be wearing the gown for, you know, months on end, and some SOPs that people have written actually require a new gown every day, you know, you can set your requirements, but you could reuse those and practically speaking, you know, just put your initials or your name on it. That way you know whose is who.
Can the BSL-2 Plus be used for mycobacteria cultures?
That would have to be done through a risk assessment. You know, Mycobacterium tuberculosis is a risk group 3 pathogen. Perhaps there might be a step with that organism or others where, you know, you get some, you know, loss of infectivity or attenuation where the risk assessment says, you know, at a certain point, something could come out of BSL-3 lab and be, you know, conducted at a lesser containment. So it would require looking at the risk group of the pathogen and then, as I said earlier, you know, really looking at the tasks and the procedures, you know, what are people going to be doing with the material? You know, we would want to really look at what the risk group is first and then start to list out everything in the risk assessment. So the answer is maybe. I'm not a mycobacteriologist, so I know there are other strains. Maybe some are not, you know, risk group 3. I'd have to go and check.
What level of detail should a BSO go into when providing in-lab BSL-2 Plus training? Sometimes a BSO has not conducted laboratory work in a long time and might be rusty with techniques used at the BL2 plus level. Can you provide comments on how to conduct in-lab training that researchers can trust?
Sure. Well, I think that's, you know, a really good point in that, you know, you want them to trust you, vice versa. You want to be able to trust them in terms of providing you with the information that you need in order to, you know, start upfront with the risk assessment. When it comes to the training, you know, I like to go into the lab and use the SOP as, you know, a starting point for the training, but it often leads to sidebar conversations, which I think, you know, with that type of training atmosphere, people are very willing to ask questions and, you know, engage in a dialogue. And oftentimes I found myself asking, you know, the scientists, you know, could you explain how you're going to do that step? Or, you know, could you walk me through the types of procedures that you're going to be doing in the lab? And then I get the opportunity to comment on, you know, areas where, you know, I might find that there's something that they can do practice-wise to enhance the safety. Or I get a better idea of, you know, what they're planning to do. So, you know, in the project registration documents, not every single last detail stepwise is necessarily in there. So this is a good opportunity for you to really engage with the people who are going to be doing the work. And, you know, I've often said that, you know, okay, we'll do this for, you know, 45 minutes and allow, you know, an extra 15 minutes for, you know, additional questions. So we schedule for, you know, an hour. And I've often been in the lab a little bit more than that, you know, the session's gone over, just because people have so many great questions. So I think if you engage them in that type of dialogue, they often, you know, find a lot of questions for you and vice versa. You know, you should not be shy. If you're not familiar with a procedure that they're going to do, you know, you need to say that. You need to say, you know, I'm not familiar with that procedure. Could you walk me through how you do that so that I can, you know, make the appropriate suggestions in terms of biosafety?
Hey, here's something interesting to those attendees here. One of our attendees says that the biosafety government agency in Canada, the Public Health Agency of Canada, has a level 2 plus checklist.
Oh, awesome.
So that may be something that folks are interested in. Again, that's the Public Health Agency of Canada. Another question, there are three questions left here. To work with wild poliovirus, what are the needs of a lab?
I would need to take that one offline. It's been a while since, you know, I had any involvement in wild poliovirus. I'm not sure even where governmental agencies are, you know, rating that in terms of, you know, risk group. I know that there, you know, polio eradication efforts were ongoing, maybe still are. That was a while ago, so I would have to take that one offline in order to give you reasonable, you know, suggestions.
Okay, there was a follow-up to that, too, so
okay.
We'll hold off on that. Here's another one. Here's the final question. How can this be applied to a clinical microbiology lab in a hospital?
Good question. So I think that for a clinical lab where, you know, you're not necessarily, you know, doing research that would come under the purview of, say, the NIH guidelines, you know, not, you know, receiving federal funding or, you know, under the auspices of a local ordinance, I think you need to look at what organisms you, you know, typically handle or have handled in the past. Look at the practices and procedures, the tasks that people are performing with those microorganisms. Look at any SOPs that you might have that may be required from a clinical lab perspective, hospital accreditation type of thing, and see where you might be able to add value to those SOPs from a biosafety standpoint. Perhaps add additional content that's more focused on biosafety. You know, typically you may, you know, while you may not have a biosafety officer like you would in a research setting, you probably have a hospital safety officer. You probably have others that are, you know, subject matter experts and infection control, infectious disease physicians that you can liaise with. But I think it really starts with looking at, you know, what do you typically handle? What kind of, you know, runoffs have you handled in the past that you perhaps didn't expect? And, you know, did they pose any additional, you know, safety hazards to personnel? Look at the tasks and procedures and the workflows, personal protective equipment requirements, things like that. And I think you can adopt a lot of the things that, you know, like, for instance, the BMBL requirements for biosafety level 2. Take a look at that and use that as a comparison for, you know, how your lab stacks up. And certainly there are, you know, many biosafety professionals that, you know, can help you if you, you know, absolutely don't know where to start, you know, in terms of the process.
Okay, thanks, Betsy. We've just about reached the end of the time, our scheduled time, and we have no more questions. So I'm going to use my authority and end the webinar now. The webinar, again, was recorded, and the recording will be made available to all the participants within the next 24 to 48 hours. Thank you all for attending, and we hope you'll join us again in the future. If you have any additional questions for Betsy, I've put her her contact information up on the screen here. Feel free to send her an email or give her a call whenever you'd like.
Especially for those that, you know, we mentioned would need to be taken offline, or the answer is, you know, it depends. So feel free to follow up with me, and, you know, I'll be happy to suggest additional resources for you.
Again, thank you very much for attending, and this is EH&E signing off.